paper, pencils, and an overactive imagination. These are the ingredients chosen to create a pretty awesome cartoon. But Cartoon Network added an extra ingredient to the concoction. Chemical, yes! The Powerpuff Girls were born! Using their ultra-super talents, Kathy Cavadini, Tara Strong, E.G. Daly, Jim Venable, Rob Renzetti, Don Shank, Craig Kelman, Chris Savino, Lauren Faust, Linda Saminsky, Paul Rudish, Jendy Tartakovsky, Craig McCracken, and the rest of the crew dedicated their lives to making cartoons and fighting the forces of evil. The city of Pittsburgh, where just minutes outside this steel metropolis in the small, small, small town of Charleroi, Pennsylvania.
It's actually so small that I did an interview for a Pittsburgh paper once, and they didn't even know where it was.
A blockheaded boy was born.
Since I was a little kid, I became obsessed with cartoons and just cartoon images. Shows like Underdog and all the superhero stuff like Superman and Batman. I started drawing when I was about 3 years old, but it just wasn't what I could see in my head at that point. Because I was three. You know, I could barely talk.
And so the drawings were saved, thanks to Dad.
I would have these, like, images in my head of drawings I wanted to see, but I couldn't draw them, I couldn't articulate them, so I would direct my dad to draw it for me. My father died when I was 7 years old, and without him there to draw for me, I really had to push myself to improve my drawing skills, you know, so I could get down on paper, you know, what I saw in my head.
The city of Los Angeles. With the passing of Craig's father, Craig's mom relocated the family to brighter, more earthquake-prone pastures. As Craig grew, so did his two biggest obsessions, drawing and cartoons.
I remember one night when I was like 12 years old, I said, I'm going to make a comic book tomorrow. I don't know why, I'm just going to make a comic book tomorrow. So I started creating characters. And basically from the point of being 12 years old all the way till I was a freshman in college, I was trying to create a character. Like, who's my character going to be?
College? Did someone say college? The campus of CalArts. It was here in the character animation department that Craig would make friends and characters that would be part of his life for years to come.
When I first got to CalArts, I met, you know, lots and lots of people, but I really formed strong relationships with, you know, a handful of people who I've continued to work with, you know, throughout my career. Guys like Paul Rudish, and he's one of the greatest draftsmen I've ever seen in my life.
He looked like a Hanna-Barbera character. He looked like the missing crew member from Goober and the Ghost Chasers. Actually, he kind of looked like Goober from the Ghost Chasers. He always wore that stocking cap. He would look like walk like Shaggy, you know.
The other two people I met at CalArts that ended up, you know, having a lifelong influence were both Rob Renzetti and Genndy Tartakovsky.
I think my first impression was of seeing him, and he was like this crazy, long-haired sad sack wearing a Jughead hat. But then after seeing his artwork and whatever, being blown away by how talented he was, and there were a lot of talented people there, but Craig was definitely one of the most talented.
Ah, shucks.
When I was at CalArts, I was always a good character designer. We would all kind of, the three of us would all help each other.
Craig was an amazing designer, but his animation just, I don't know if he just wasn't interested in it as much as maybe we were. So then my character design abilities weren't strong at all, and so we kind of switched roles. So I would help Craig with the timing and animation, and he'd help me with the designs.
So what's a Jughead hat-wearing, good character design and limited animating student to do next? Make a film!
I came up with this silly character called No Neck Joe, and just did the dumbest jokes I possibly could do about a guy not having a neck, you know, two, you know, bullies giving him a turtleneck and a necktie, and, you know, giraffes laughing at him at the zoo, and just, you know, Dracula wanting to bite him on the neck, because they were just absurd little things.
After cornering the market on jokes about not having a neck, Craig started to think about what his next CalArts film might be.
And I wanted to do some sort of a superhero thing, and I was inspired by this thing that Joe Horn made for MTV called Stevie Washington, the Angry Youth, and I really liked how quick and kind of almost spontaneous his little films were. And it was around June, and my mom said, you know, hey, your brother's birthday's coming up, why don't you do a card for him? So I just started doodling these little things, and for some reason I was thinking about Keen paintings, and I actually ended up drawing this this little tiny drawing. I'm like, wow, that's really cool. So I was kind of got obsessed with that, and I ended up giving this to my brother for his birthday instead of a card. And originally I was going to cast El Fuego, the Mexican wrestler. But as soon as I drew these girls, I went, forget about the Mexican wrestler guy. What if I put these three little girls in instead of that guy? And I've got these three cute little Sanrio-looking characters beating up giant monsters. They'll seem much stronger and much more heroic in contrast because they look so innocent and harmless.
And thus the idea for his second-year film was born. So, Blossom, Bubbles, and
Bud, because I thought, well, that's appropriate. She's kind of a tomboy, more tomboy than the other two. And I was like, but it just feels, it doesn't roll off the tongue nice. Blossom, Bubbles, and Bud. It just kind of hangs there. So I was like racking my brain for a while. And a friend of mine, Miles Thompson, actually came up with the name Buttercup. And I was like, oh, that works. Blossom, Bubbles, and Buttercup.
Yes, go on.
My friend Tim Myers used to say whoop-ass, open a can of whoop-ass all the time, and then I misheard a Black Francis lyric in a Pixie song where he says my roof has walls, and I thought he always said my whoop-ass balls, and I was like, I like the word whoop-ass, that's rad. My goal was to do four student films, four adventures of the whoop-ass girls.
This is so ambitious, you are nuts. So we were like, good luck with that, but he ended up producing one and putting it in color, and it was pretty amazing.
Oh, yes, but that one film did not go unnoticed. Craig's teacher asked that he show it to Linda Saminsky of Nickelodeon Development. Go, girls, go!
I could tell when I looked at it that, you know, he was a really talented guy, and I remember thinking that his project at the time wasn't exactly the direction that Nick was going in.
Oh, yeah? Well, you know what? We'll show you! Someday, somehow, this will become something for some network that will not exist for some time. So there, the studio of Hanna-Barbera. Unfazed by the pseudo-rejection, Craig left CalArts for the home of Fred and Scooby and started working with two stupid dogs and seven smart CalArts friends.
Here we were, just a bunch of young kids out of CalArts, kind of given the chance to work on a television series.
We started coming in. And we're young, and we have all these ideas, and we want to change stuff and do stuff differently.
It was great, though. We loved it. We had so much fun. We'd sit down and work, and then some days we'd just be going wild for, like, hours.
Early on, when I was doing a freelance storyboard for Dexter's Lab, like, I really want to work on this show. And I was told, no, that's, like, a total club there. Those guys are all CalArts pals. They don't allow anyone else in. I'm like, I'm going to make it. It's true. But it wasn't exclusive. It was just because we were a bunch of dumb nerds.
But one day, one of those dumb nerds thought he'd take a chance and show his little girls to the studio bigwigs.
So I took it up to the development department and pitched it to Margot McDonough, and she got on the phone and called up Fred Seibert, who was president of Hanna-Barbera at the time. I showed him my student film, and he was like, let's start negotiating for a series. And that was in 93, I believe. And I went back in the trailer with all the guys, and I said, I just think I sold a series. I think I just sold 13 and a half hours of Whoop-Ass Girls.
Woo! Go, girls, go!
So I was really excited about that, and we started, you know, obvious contract negotiations for the series. As we were negotiating that, Hanna-Barbera kind of figured their whole development plan and went, we're not going to greenlight series, we're going to start a shorts program. Then we're going to produce it with Cartoon Network, and this is where we'll find our next series.
So, foiled again, but hey, at least we got a short. So get ready, cartoon fans, because here come the
We recorded the first short with Whoop-Ass. It went through fine, and Mike Lazo, the creative head of Cartoon Network, was at this cable buyers conference. He said, yeah, we're making this new short called The Whoop-Ass Girls. And someone, some cable buyer or somebody stopped him and said, what?
And there were tons of different names. Yeah. It was hard getting past Whoop-Ass for him for a long time.
I couldn't for the life of me come up with another name. And we came up with every iteration that we could. And just nothing was fitting. And I was like, none of these things felt right. And separately, two friends of mine, Paul Rudish and Zeke Cam, had actually come up with Powerpuff on their own. I was like, ah, that's not bad. That's pretty good. I like that. So I kind of sat on it for a few days, and I thought it was interesting. They both came up with it. And so then I just went, okay, that's going to be it. It's going to be Powerpuff.
I think they should have kept it as Whoop-Ass Girls.
Oh, big whoop. We had to change the title. That didn't mean the girls weren't still all sugar, spice, everything nice, and an accidental can of whoopee.
We had to think of a replacement for the can of whoop-ass, and so we just, it had to be some generic, mysterious concoction, so we came up with Chemical X. Now, there's this whole subgroup of people out there who really think the whole show is all about ecstasy. It's not. Chemical X just sounded mysterious, and it was quick, and it was just like, okay, fine, Chemical X.
Now we had a short with a kosher cable operator-approved name and some totally non-drug-related ingredient thrown into the mix. And it instantly was a hit, got greenlit into a series, and kids around the world loved it. Yes! Go, girls! Yes, what? What? Now what?
The first thing the network does is they want to get an impression of what kids think of it. So they do focus testing where they get a bunch of kids in a room, they show them these cartoons, and just get their feedback.
We were called in, filled with excitement, told we were going to be shown a cartoon like we had never seen before. It was true.
This is the worst cartoon ever!
Jimmy Jerkface, 11 years old.
It's terrible! What are they, bugs or something?
Billy Big Mouth, 10.
I'm gonna be sick!
Peter Puker, age 11.
Whoever made this should be fired!
Mitch, the evilest child in the world, Mitchelson, 5.
I'm sitting there with the president of Hanna-Barbera and Cartoon Network execs and behind this glass and going, well, there goes my career. I just totally blew it. I'm not going to ever get a chance to make this as a series.
Kids weren't as used to watching them, and this had a real personality and attitude and voice that nobody had seen, so there was going to be a little bit of a learning curve.
Craig, like, panicked that afternoon, and he came back that evening and redesigned the whole show in a night.
I went, they're too weird. They don't have fingers, they don't have ears, and some people thought they were bugs.
I was in that focus group. I had a problem with the fingers.
But I got this call from Mike Lazo, and he basically told me, he said, Craig, look, we like this short. And I know you got a negative reaction, but I'm much more interested in a negative reaction than a lukewarm reaction. We believe in it, and we want to do another short with it.
Let's try this again. Got short number 2. Great, good, got it done. Now we're sure to go to series. So let's go, girls. Go on, now what?
Dexter's got greenlit first.
Dexter's Laboratory, a short about a kid scientist and his annoying sister, created by Gendy and brought to life with help from Craig and Paul. It was Cartoon Network's first original series.
So Craig became the art director. He also storyboarded a bunch of episodes. He was always in the writing team.
He did a couple of boards that I just thought were the best things I'd ever seen. And I remember saying to Mike Lazo at that point, if Craig can do boards that are that funny, he can probably do anything. So maybe we should just go back to Powerpuff.
In a weird way, I was glad I got to wait. I was glad we got to do 4 seasons of Dexter's and really learn how to make cartoons and tell stories and communicate characters.
We made a lot of mistakes on Dexter and a lot of good things, but that's the way, you know, that's the way you kind of learn. And so, yeah, it was invaluable to have that experience going for our second series.
Really?
Look,
for reals this time?
Girls.
Don't mess with me. Well, okay. This is gonna feel good. Go, girls! Go! The city of Townsville! Craig learned from working on Dexter's that the secret to any good show is great characters. So he tossed out his pitch for an all-background show and populated his world with some of the most bizarre inhabitants to ever grace the TV screen.
We realized that the girls kind of form one complete person. Like, separately, they're not as strong as they are together, and they're basically body, mind, and spirit.
I play Blossom, and she is the leader. She has red hair, just like me, and she's highly intelligent, just like me.
No, I'm kidding.
and she's a little bossy.
Yeah.
A little?
She's, okay, a little.
Oh, no, you don't! Doing? You don't want to do it the proper way, then you don't do it. Come on, Bubbles. Fine.
Buttercup, I think, is the feisty of the feistiest, and I think loses her temper the most. But I think she's very committed to what she's all about.
Who's the strongest? Who's the toughest? Who's the coolest? Who should rule? Me!
Bubbles is sweet, and
She's very honest. Like, she just is who she is, and she makes no apologies for it, and she'll talk to squirrels, and she'll try to save the day her own way, and she gets a lot of flack from the other girls because she's the tough one, and she's the boss, and she's, like, they consider her the baby, so she, like, often tries to show that she's just as tough as they are, and I like when she gets hardcore and gets into it, but, you know.
Hardcore!
Mostly she's the cutest, so that's why I got that role.
Buttercup hurt Mojo's head, and I wore the sissy with her boo-boo, but then I remembered he was a bad monkey, so I kicked him in his face!
You know, we try to evoke a little bit of the girls' personalities in their design in the sense that, you know, Blossom's the leader, so she's the one who has the bow. It's almost like the crown. She's like the central point. And, you know, Bubbles being the cuter one, you know, her pigtails are softer and a little, you know, girlier. And Buttercup being the aggressive one has the sharper, pointed, you know, short bob haircut and a little more angles in her design.
That particular style that he had was not common at that point. You know, there were a couple of new styles of animation on the air at that point, but not that particular sort of Hanna-Barbera meets UPA kind of look that Craig and Gendy were both doing. And so, you know, it really stood out. It was really interesting.
In the early 90s, you didn't see a lot of that graphic, you know, fat black line stuff. And, you know, we did it with Dexter's and we did it with Powerpuff. And it kind of, I think when you're flipping channels, those shows really pop.
But design-wise, character-wise, you know, and we were following Craig's thing, but we wanted the rest of the world to not, I mean, the girls had to be special, you know, so they're all curves, you know, all round, ellipses, and, you know, really cute, and so we had a lot of other, you know, angular characters, and you know, offset them, make them seem even stranger, right? So there's a little more influenced by, like, 50s cartoons and 50s and 60s.
Boring.
Yeah, I'm falling asleep.
And what would our good little heroes be without big bad villains? So Craig dug deep into his pop culture warp brain and summoned forth a cornucopia of evildoers.
Kind of what we did with the villains is, in my mind, I created this scale of how evil and how dumb. And basically, the amoebas are on the bottom end of that as the dumbest, pathetic, you can't achieve anything villain. And him is on the other end as the most evil villain. And Mojo's great because he's right in the middle. So you can make him stupid if you wanted to, but you could push him and make him a little more evil. And then the other villains kind of fall in different levels on that kind of graph in my mind. Mojo, one, monkeys are always good. Evil monkeys are great. So that's just a cool visual to start with. But the green face, there was a show in the 70s from Japan called Spectre Man, and Spectre Man had this evil villain in Dr. Gory, who's this green-faced monkey, and it just looked cool. And then, like, his whole dialogue is based on, like, the English translation of Speed Racer.
I do not talk like that. The way I communicate is much different. I do not reiterate, repeat, reinstate the same thing over and over again. I am clear, concise, to the point.
The guys like the Gangrene Gang, the basic idea with them was, what if Big Daddy Roth designed Fat Albert and the Cosby Kid?
Boys!
Why is it?
The amoebas were just classic, you know, thugs. You know, gangster thugs. And I just thought it was cool that they were bacteria. And then Fuzzy was kind of just, I think he was based on some sidekick character from Rainbow Bright.
Anyone else want to try and get on my property?
Basically, him was, you know, my attempt to do a Blue Meanie. He originally was the devil.
Oh, I'm a scared. Okay. That weird red lady man thing creeps me out.
Professor is, you know, typical 50s dad mixed with Bob Dobbs from Church of the Subgenius. You know, just trying to get that kind of Devo guy in there, just the classic 50s father figure. The mayor is Monopoly guy meets Mayor McCheese.
And we can't forget the mayor's. Whoa! Hello. The mayor's.
Let me help you with that.
What were we doing? Some kind of documentary or something? I forget.
People have always asked about Cerebellum, like, why don't you show her face? And whether this joke worked or not, the idea was that she is the typical classic hot assistant that you would think every politician or executive would have. So you don't show her best feature. Her best feature is her mind.
And originally they're like, oh, you can't draw that much cleavage, and the sensors were, you know, you have to tune that back on the models. And so we'd go back and revamp the model page,
shore up her collar and button her blouse. And then, so they stamped approved on the model page, and then we went back to storyboarding and just drew her blouse so as open as we wanted to, and the crew overseas went ahead and augmented that even more.
Nice.
Cartoon Network Studios, with the green light to go, Craig pushed the magical Make Cartoon button on the big cartoon-making machine, and in a flash, the show instantly appeared on TV screens across the world. And the rest is history. What? There's no button.
Okay.
So these guys and the rest of the crew that we couldn't afford to interview sat down and, did some things that I'm not really sure of. Sorry, I'm still hung up on the button thing.
Well, the basic production process on the show would be myself and some of the board artists and directors and guys, we'd just get together in a room and we would just start tossing ideas around.
And the story meetings especially, I mean, they weren't necessarily story meetings, they were joke fests, everybody throwing jokes at one another, and someone would go, oh, you know, that would make a great story, and then suddenly you'd build a story upon that, and it was like out of one joke.
Once we settled upon that, we would write an outline, which basically broke down the main beats of the story. And then we'd give that to a storyboard artist.
Storyboarding is making the comic book of the story before it goes into production.
As we were drawing out our storyboard, we also got to write the dialogue and figure out the pacing.
They would come into a room and pitch the board to the whole crew. And then once we had the pitch, we'd go through that and tweak things and add gags or subtract gags or, you know, whatever. You would kind of work it until you felt it was good.
If you threw a pencil at you, you knew the pitch was not good.
Yeah.
I went to my very first pitch, and I went through it with the most minute detail. I explained every little drawing, every little action, and Craig and Gendy were the people I had to please. And Gendy came up to me and just said, you need to learn how to pitch faster. I pitch much faster now. I've really learned my lesson.
Once that board's been approved by the network, you then record all the voices.
Well, here's Fortune Bubbles. You bring sunshine to all who surround you. Hi-doo! What's yours? Your quality is that of a leader. Others are sure to follow you.
Ooh, that's true.
What's yours, Buttercup?
Be not violent or angry. Peace lies within. What a stupid Fortune. Wasn't even funny.
They all have this amazing ability to harmonize with each other, just doing their character voices.
La, 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 makes the world go round.
And then we'd take this whole package, which was the storyboard, the X sheets, all of the design work, and we would send that package almost as a blueprint to our overseas studio, Rough Draft Studios in Korea, and they would take this blueprint and then make the show. They would literally do all the animation. They would actually lay out the shots. They would animate the characters. They would color all the scenes, paint all the backgrounds, film everything, and then send us back film. And then we would then call retakes on that film, saying this scene's wrong, or this is wrong, or there's a color pop here, or this isn't supposed to be timed this way. We'd cut it together, and then we'd start post-production, which is giving the film to the sound effects guy and to the composer.
I started thinking in terms of, well, who's Blossom? Who's Bubbles and who's Buttercup and what are their attitudes? And that's when ideas of like sort of giving Blossom a heroic brass kind of sound, giving Bubbles the belly kind of cute sound, and then giving Buttercup her kind of rock sensibility, her sort of edge, if you will.
We really wanted to score it like you would score a movie where the music emotionally, you know, builds up and moves around based on the emotional story you're trying to tell.
There were so many larger-than-life moments that it really demanded big, giant score as well. So really the sort of tone and sound of the music of the show became 50s monster music meets 60s techno.
It's good.
Dun 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 dun. I'm not a singer.
And then once you had that, you would do the final delivery of a finished episode to Cartoon Network.
Wait, that was just one episode? And you guys made 137 of these things? Woo! No wonder Craig's got those raccoon eyes. Work, work, work. That can't be all these people did. Come on, let's get some dirt.
It was a fun show. I mean, it was an amazing show. We're so many stories, right? We can't even, I mean, like, where do we start?
Yeah, it's mind-boggling.
That's why we're having trouble really getting going, because there's just, I mean, the stories are countless. Like, there was the one where Craig didn't walk into my office that one day and didn't say anything, and it was uneventful. That was really, really crazy.
Shocking.
She was always, you know, like either.
Yeah, look at I'm a mom.
Her cell phone would go off.
Oh, scandalous! Come on, guys, give me something crazy. Don't hold back.
I was wearing a pirate hat.
They used to call me Lingo.
Shower curtain rings. They were everywhere.
Naked mayor. Naked mayor. Naked mayor.
Yeah, we want to get the light off those nipples.
They just explode and die.
I have a malformed rib.
Okay.
Right when we started the show, the Nintendo 64 came out, and everybody on the crew was playing Legend of Zelda, myself included. So it got to the point where we had a production meeting because some of the guys were late on their boards, and Gendy and I sat down with everybody, and I was like, all right, what level is everyone on in Zelda? Who's almost finished? And Gendy got so mad.
Every time a new video game came out, that was just ridiculous.
Basically, the studio shut down for about a month so that we could all
get
just
level
get through that. And then we'd come to work and we'd collaborate on like all the puzzle-solving techniques. And did you get this clue? And oh, what you need to do? And give each other hints. And that's pretty much what the workday was about.
Yeah, you nerds may draw girls, but I bet you never talked to one.
And of course, the biggest highlight of working on the show was meeting my husband, Craig McCracken.
Nyanya, Craig and Lauren sitting in a tree. DRAWING.
Drawing.
And my friend Randy Myers was a timing director on Powerpuff Girls and told me that they were looking for story artists, and I was actually a big fan of the show.
So I went to Randy and I'm like, who is this girl that keeps coming in and see, who is she? What is going on? I mean, she's really cute. And he's like, oh, that's my friend Lauren. She's taking a board test. I'm like, oh, okay, all right. But, you know, just, she's single?
Love tends to cloud judgment. So Craig got a second opinion to make sure he was thinking with his head and not his pickle. Thank you, Mayor.
I took the test to Gendy, and I said, Gendy, you know, take a look at this test. She's a friend of Randy's. And he's like, well, what do you think? And I'm like, just look at it. Just look at it. So he went into his office, and a few minutes later came out, and he's like, this is really good. This is really good. I was like, that's what I thought. Great. I think we should hire her. So I was guilt-free.
Oh, goody! It was a very nerve-wracking experience for me because he was coming around to talk to me all the time, and I was falling for him, but I was so afraid of what people would think. And because it was getting so distracting for me at a certain point, I realized that I wasn't getting my work done because I was so preoccupied with all this. I was like, well, if I don't start dating him, I'm going to get fired because I'm not getting my work done.
As our lovers' hearts were exploding, something else was as well. Craig's little girls were getting bigger than he ever imagined.
I thought at best we would make a show that kids would like and find fun, and then maybe kind of some hipster college kids would cue in on. It wasn't designed to be a hit, kind of just happened naturally.
We were able to make what was in our minds and not be inundated with standards and practices notes, etc., like what you can and can't do.
There was trust.
Pretty much Cartoon Network was pretty open about letting us get away with things.
We were able to give him a lot of creative freedom. We opted to work with him knowing that he was very much in sync with what we were trying to do.
It gave this show that was predominantly a kid's show, it gave it a little bit of an edge that an adult watching could pick up on and go, oh, I appreciate that. That joke's for me. That's not for my kid. And it's okay that my kid doesn't understand it, but there's something I can get out of it, which is true to classic cartoon making. You know, Bugs Bunny, you know, has those elements.
Bubbles, it's a bow tie and it goes down here. And cologne, specimens, and cup drinks, and some of these.
We never really made the show for kids. We always just made it for us.
I think it was very exciting at the time for Cartoon Network to actually have a hit.
An action-packed cartoon.
The LA Weekly raves.
Perfect.
And the New York Times calls it
appealingly eclectic and sardonically hip.
USA Today says, the Powerpuff Girls
should appeal to cartoon fans of all ages.
Within about 3 weeks of it being on the air, they started getting calls to license them.
And boy, did they ever license those girls!
maybe if we were lucky, we'd get maybe like a few T-shirts in a couple of record stores or some hip stores. I mean, that's all I really thought could possibly happen. And the next thing you knew, it blew up, and it was pretty much everywhere.
These are like freaking
cool.
Huge.
We had this episode called Collector, where there was this character, this villain named Lenny Baxter, and he was collecting all the Powerpuff merchandise. But we couldn't use any real merchandise because it might appear to be a commercial for the products. So we started coming up with the most obscure things, like meat packing things and golf clubs and waffle makers, and just like, okay, this is never going to happen. And it got to the point where the products got so crazy that there were waffle makers. Delta produced this plane that would just fly up and down the coast, and the Powerpuff Girls were on it. The real one's a lot bigger than this. It has gotten to a certain point where there was so much merchandise, and the only way I could find out what was getting made was to go onto eBay.
And it wasn't just your standard dolls, T-shirts, and airplanes that featured the girls. There were reimagined spin-off series, freaky costume stage performances, chart-topping albums. But all of these amazing things paled in comparison to the one piece of merchandise that sealed Powerpuff Girls into pop culture history.
If you get a pinata, that means you've made it.
Okay, a hit show, rich fat cats, scary knockoffs from Mexico, and more stuff than you can fill a landfill with. What's next?
They just said, we need to make a movie. I think for me, the products had become so girly, and all of a sudden jewelry kits started coming out and makeup kits and everything was pink, and I was like, no, this is not what this is. This is about three kids who fight crime and beat up giant monsters and bad guys. And I saw the movie as a chance to reclaim the mantle of the Warpath Girls in a weird way. Just like, no, we're gonna make an action adventure movie, and it's gonna be powerful like you've never seen it before. The movie got mixed reviews. One that always sticks in my mind, and they said it was an orgy of senseless and violent destruction. And it was like, okay, I don't know that they hated it, but you know, ultimately, like, it ended up. I'm proud to say on Rotten Tomatoes as fresh. In hindsight, maybe I wish it was a little sillier, a little lighter, a little more, not so heavy the whole time.
Well, look on the bright side.
You know, here it is years later. It still, you know, works as a story. It's still a good experience, a good viewing experience, really.
Once we finished the movie, the network wanted more episodes, and so we started up producing more shows. And midway through the production on that, Cartoon Network kind of came to me and said, "We want another show from you." So I came up with Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends and handed the reins of Powerpuff over to Chris Savino.
We had done so many stories that it felt like, well, who's the monster this time? What's the joke? How do they fight him? What happens in the, you know, when they come together in the end? So it was tough, but it's a really difficult pair of shoes to fill if you don't have the person whose vision it is filtering everything through them, or at least asking them. And not that he wasn't available to talk to, but he too was very busy. But ultimately, we were proud of the shows we did.
At a certain point, Cartoon Network came to us and said, well, what about seven? What about a seventh season? And Chris and I both said, no, I think it's time. It's over with. It had its run. It kind of ran its course. And we would hate to continue making a show when we're just kind of hitting the same notes and repeating ourselves. And we want to kind of go out while it still was good.
And so, from a blockheaded boy obsessed with cartoons to a blockheaded man obsessed with cartoons, Craig McCracken created some of the funniest and weirdest cartoon... Wait, hold on. Does this mean it's over? No, it can't be. It can't be over. I hate goodbyes. No, girls, no! Don't go, girls, go!
2008 is the 10-year anniversary of the premiere of Powerpuff Girls. And to celebrate the 10-year anniversary, we're doing a new episode. Just a new 22-minute episode.
Woo! 10-year anniversary, baby! Yeah! And that means it's not over. That means there'll be more stupid, silly butt-kicking, more maniacal monkeys, flamboyant demons, and furry hillbillies. But most importantly, it means that I get to say...
So, once again,
the day
is saved.
Thanks
to...
The Powerpuff Girls!
Tom, you're out of a job.